Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford Art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, but most importantly, I'm your chief investigator of images. I'm coming to you from a wonderful place today, the Watts Gallery in Compton, which is just outside Guildford, and a real treasure trove. It has thoroughly excited me, opened my eyes, and I'm here for a new exhibition, which we're going to talk a bit about. And I'm joined by Nick Tromans, who is the curator here, aren't you?
That is correct. Thank you, Janina. Great to hear your enthusiastic words. The exhibition we've got on that we're standing in is called G.F. Watts, England's Michelangelo. Mm. Quite a grand title.
Big claim. So
big
come
claim.
On, Nick, how do we support
big
this claim?
Well, first of all, it was a phrase used by Watts's contemporaries. He lived in the 19th century, a Victorian, at a period when artists were taken hugely seriously by their contemporaries, and this was a nickname that Watts was given. It was given partly because of his huge ambitions. Just looking around the room we're standing in now, you can see these massive, multi-metre-tall pictures with these grandiose figures. But also because of the range of the artist. Watts was a painter of oil pictures, of frescoes, murals, a great draftsman, also a very great and ambitious sculptor. Mm. So that range of media was felt to reflect back upon the Renaissance. Also, Watts had lived in Italy for several years, and he liked to look the part of a Renaissance artist wearing a great cloak and a little skull cap. So he was often felt to be a kind of Renaissance artist who had somehow popped up again in Victorian England.
Right. So you see, the claim seems more supported once you look at the themes as well, because what I love about this exhibition, when's the exhibition running? Do you give us the dates?
The exhibition closes on the 26th of November.
Oh, hurry
so
up,
So do
people.
Please hurry. You've got a few weeks left, but not long. Yeah, 26th
of November. But there is a
November.
Permanent collection here at Watts anyway that you
there
can
is.
See, isn't there?
There is. Our collection is based primarily on the work of G.F. Watts. We have the largest collection of his work anywhere, and for this exhibition we've augmented that collection with some super duper highlights from other collections. The good news is that some of the super generous lenders, both museums and private collectors, are going to let us hang on to some of these loans after the end of the exhibition. So even if you can't make it here by the 26th, still come, because you'll see some special things.
Well, I have been utterly blown away by the loan you've got from Toronto, is it?
That's right, yeah.
Is it called the Sower of the Systems?
Let's have a look at it.
Yeah, well, we're gonna focus in on his famous big hit, Hope, aren't we? But I do think we can have a look at the ones that you've managed to get along, because, to be honest, this excites me the most.
Well, I think you're not alone there amongst art historians. A lot of art historians have found this to be a really particular the exciting picture in Watts' late work. He painted it when he was something like 86.
86 years old, because he lived a long life,
he
didn't
he? He had a sort of 70-year career, started amazing. Work as a teenager, died with his boots on at 87. So he has a very long career. And this, as you can see, is, well, you want to call it a figure. It's not even really a figure. It's like an animated cloak moving dramatically diagonally across the picture plane.
The only real indication of humanity, really, is the hand, isn't it? And the rest is all suggested, and the foot.
Just about get a foot, a heel, and you can just about get a hand, but the hand is so stylized, it's hardly a hand, is it? It's all more like some kind of explosion.
But the colour, I mean, it's the colour. I walked into this room, and that burst, it is like flame coming out of the canvas, isn't it? And for him to have been so elderly when he created it as well, I mean, it's, to me, this is truly visionary stuff.
Well, the timing is fascinating. It dates from the beginning of the 20th century. Watts was absolutely a Victorian. In fact, his memories go all the way back to the 1830s. So he has a hugely long career, but he lives into the 20th century. And of course, as you'll know, as an art historian, abstract painting officially gets its starting pistol just a few years after this. So it really is on the cusp of symbolism morphing into abstraction. And because it was executed at the very end of Watts's career, and the artist died soon afterwards, the picture kind of didn't become famous in its own day. It's been retrospectively rediscovered as a picture that looks ahead to abstraction, and indeed to the way that art and science can speak to each other. This is arguably the first image of the Big Bang. It's meant to be the moment of the creation of the universe, but personified and expressed as an allegory.
And this is what I find absolutely fascinating about Watts. I love him because he is a man poised on the modern world, but he is looking back to the classical tradition, to the great tradition of history paintings, of, you know, large canvases that tell you a story to improve you. And so he's personified the sower of the solar, of the systems. But actually, he's getting this inspiration from the very earliest developments of telescopes and things, isn't he?
Exactly right. So Watts was a great reader of the newspapers of the day. He and his wife, Mary Watts, used to cuddle up in the evenings and read the latest literature to each other.
She's brilliant too, though, isn't she, Mary?
Well, she's a fascinating figure, absolutely, and she's someone whose story we've only really been uncovering in the last few years. But one thing we've learned through Mary Watts's diary is exactly what they did read to each other.
Gosh.
And one of the books we know they read together was, just as you say, a book that was what we would now call a kind of popularising book of science.
Really?
It wasn't written by a research scientist, but a book that reproduced some of the first long-range astronomical photography, so that anybody could pick up this book from the high street and see these distant galaxies for the first time. And Watts was blown away by this in his 80s. And he did what people had done for millennia, which was to look at these beautiful patterns and start to read into them human and animal shapes. And so he's imagined being able to see within these amazing spiraling patterns of the galaxies a human figure. I always compare it to an Olympic hammer thrower, you know, gearing up round and round and then finally...
It totally has that feeling. It's like it's absolutely in motion. And actually, that's what I find. There is a drama and movement in so many of his paintings. I'm enamoured with that one over there, the Endymion, which, again, I love, because Endymion, you know, the myth, the story that Diana is so in love with him that he wants him to have eternal youth. But then he becomes this sort of static sculpture figure at the bottom, and she is this fluid arc of energy. I mean, that to me is scientific, like a ball of energy, don't you think?
I mean these parallels between art and science are very interesting. I mean, to me that looks like some kind of, exactly as you said, disembodied figure, a wave pattern perhaps.
Absolutely.
You know, you think about all the early science of the late 19th century of the new understanding of energy transmitted through wave patterns. That's kind of what it looks like to me. This is an interesting example of a picture that Watts came to and went away from and came back to over decades. We think it was begun as early as the 1860s.
Really? Because it's not finished till almost his death.
Till his death. And then laid aside, and we do have some photographs of this very canvas in our archive, which show that by around 1900 it still wasn't quite finished.
Gosh.
So he's obviously come back to it right at the very end of his life and repeated himself. There's Endymion's dog. Some people call it a lion, but I'm saying it's a dog. He being a shepherd and all. The figure of the male character, as you say, is like a sculpture. He's borrowed from the Elgin marbles, from the Parthenon frieze, or pediment sculptures, rather. And there, Diana imagined, again, as this divine presence. Watts was, like so many late Victorian agnostics, haunted by the idea of divinity. He of course, he didn't believe any longer in a, as he put it himself, in a wise old man with a big beard making everything hunky-dory. What he did believe in were parallels between ancient beliefs in God and divinities and modern science. He even almost at some points seems to say that he believes that science is God, that the laws of science are the laws of religion. So there's this fascinating mixing up of myth, legend and science in his late work that academics and the public, I have to say, are really responsive to.
I think that's what makes him in so many ways such a modern
Victorian painter, because it's not the old allegories, it's not all biblical material. I mean, there are these so many nods to classical myths in here, and I love the fact that Diana is shaped like a crescent moon as well, sort of referencing her role as moon goddess. But alongside us, we've got these three portraits of Eve, which, you know, again, you could say this is an altarpiece, this is a triptych, this is religious, but it's messing with the religious ideas, isn't it?
It's using the shapes, the formats, it's arguably borrowing the authority of religious art and then sticking into it something different, something slightly different, sticking into it allegories of modern life, modern feeling. Now, when I say modern life, I do not mean, you know, he's gone down the post office or the local railway station. He did do a bit of that, realism, back in the 1840s as
did
a
he?
Young man. Yeah.
I can't imagine him painting trains.
So I'm exaggerating slightly, but he did paint, well, we can just about see it from here.
Oh, the boat.
Found Drowned.
Oh,
that
Found
amazing
Drowned,
image
yes.
of the woman who's thrown herself off Waterloo Bridge. I'd say it's the picture that gets reproduced most in
really?
That collection. Yeah, more people asked to borrow that or to reproduce it. And we have another picture in the collection, not presently on show, a hugely emotive picture of the Irish famine. Probably the only large-scale painting by an English artist of the Irish famine during the tragedies taking place in the 1840s.
Because that's the other thing we have to note about Watts, isn't it? That he's a philanthropist, he's deeply invested in social regeneration at lots of different levels, isn't he?
We actually held a conference in this very room 4 days ago on Monday that asked the question, how did artists in the late 19th century take advantage of their increased social status and standing to follow and promote political causes in which they were interested in. So that ranges all the way from someone like Holman Hunt, the Pre-Raphaelite, who was a passionate Zionist that came out of his knowledge of Jerusalem, to someone like Watts, whose passions were much more about liberal politics, which were about the promotion of women in society, which were about things like animal rights. In other words, all the kind of causes that today nobody would blink an eye at. But
so
in the 19th
soft
century,
liberal causes, though,
soft liberal
they?
Causes, and what's his connection to what we would now call liberal politics? Goes all the way back to the 1840s when he was promoted by a circle of aristocratic liberal politicians and landowners who supported his early career, and that belief in a kind of progress driven ultimately by an elite is something he believes in. Watts was never a William Morris-style revolutionary. Watts was never to be found on any barricade when he went near one. Yeah, but he had this strange authority, partly by his consistency of vision and his relentless pursuit of the same few fundamental themes for 50, 60 years. By the time he was an old man, people looked to him as a guru, as a leader, as a figure of great moral authority. So people would come and ask him the most extraordinary questions. They'd say to him, Mr. Watts, this is like in the 1890s. What do you think about the bicycle? Then a brand new sort of shocking thing. Mr. Watts, what do you think about the trade union agitation of the day? What do you think about women's suffrage? And people wanted his opinion because he was this grand old man who could name drop Disraeli, could name drop Gladstone, Tennyson, Swinburne. You know, you name it, he'd met them in the 19th century. And that, by 1900, say, seemed to be a huge presence in British culture. Watts was this kind of national treasure.
But he was also deeply tied into celebrity, wasn't he? I mean, that's one of the themes of this exhibition, because he painted the portraits of very important people.
Very important people, some very glamorous people. That is one of the intriguing and rather some touching things about Watts, that on one hand, he had this very slightly portentous, one might even say pompous approach to portraiture, which was that he wanted to make sure that the National Portrait Gallery in London did not risk missing getting hold of images of the people who were great and still living. Because when the Portrait Gallery was founded, an immediate problem was, oh, crumbs, there seem to be all these famous British people back in the, you name it, whichever century, we don't have any portraits of them. So Watts said, well, let's make sure we don't make the same mistake in our own age. I'll go and paint them right now. Great. But then he seemed to sort of have this quite sort of penchant for sort of ringing up, or, you know, writing to famous actresses, so, you know, Lily Langtry, you know, the great beauties of the day, saying, I think you ought to come have your portrait painted. And then he would chat away at them, and he would never quite finish the portrait, and, you know, he would have this incredible social life, and he became incredibly well-connected and incredibly well-informed about the politics and social life of the day without ever leaving home. because people just came to him to have his portrait, their portraits painted. Everybody from, as I say, glamorous actresses to great imperial statesmen to churchmen, scientists, actually not so many scientists, but a couple, musicians, but above all, authors and painters. Those were the people he really was interested in, writers and painters.
Now, there is a slightly unfortunate connection between him and Cecil Rhodes, isn't there? Now, how did that come about?
Well, if we think that Cecil Rhodes is unfortunate, which is fair enough, then, you know, Rhodes came into contact with an awful lot of people and places.
Exactly.
And one of the people he came into contact with was Watts. Watts had a big house in London, and it was well
known. Next door to Leighton.
Right next door
really
to Leighton House. That's right.
I mean, because Leighton House so chimes with these sorts of colours and textures, doesn't it?
And it's a great loss that sadly, whilst Leighton House, thank goodness, survives as a wonderful museum, Watts's house was demolished in the 1960s. But that house in London had a sign outside it saying, you know, this is the residence of Mr. G.F. Watts. Please come in and look at the picture gallery.
Wow.
Watts was, as you were saying quite rightly earlier, was a great one for, you know, a liberal thinking, opening up stuff for everybody. He wanted people to come in and see his picture. So anybody could walk it up the street. And the story goes that Cecil Rhodes was walking down the street, saw this sign and went in and said to Mr. Watts, I think you should paint my portrait. Mm. Do you know who I am? Mm. I'm terribly important. Then Rhodes dies young. People often forget this, that Rhodes dies in his 40s.
Gosh, I didn't realize
that. He dies very young with this kind of, as it was seen at the time, huge ambition incomplete, as we would now say, you know, the ambition is probably too nice a word for it. program of well, now is not the proper occasion to go into it, to choose the perfect words, but obviously opinions about those who expanded the British Empire using violence has changed a kind of 180 degrees. Of course it has. Now, what happened with Watts was that Watts did paint Rhodes's portrait. Watts instinctively disliked him to start with, but then did come to feel some respect for what he'd achieved, or at least from what Watts was told he'd achieved. Watts never went to Africa, so of course never saw with his own eyes. But there was a famous sculpture that Watts was still working on when he was visited by Rhodes called Physical Energy. Huge horse with a huge rider. Incredible object. And a bit like Sir of the Systems that we were looking at, a work that stands on the cusp again between, I think, symbolism and
modernism. It's always got futurist elements because the way that the horse's body is reduced and the legs become mobile in a way I've never seen in an equestrian sculpture. It is an extraordinary sculpture.
It's absolutely unique. I mean, it's very, very difficult to think of anything else to compare it to, apart from, as you say, maybe paintings by people like the futurists. That's very interesting. But the British government felt Rhodes had died too young. They wanted to commemorate him. They felt, as often happens when a sort of hugely famous person dies young, there's a huge outpouring of national emotion. People think we must do something. There has to be a big monument. So the government said, well, what would be an appropriate image to represent Rhodes's incredible drive? And everyone said, well, some people said, Physical Energy by G.F. Watts. So the sculpture was cast to become part of the Rhodes Memorial just outside Cape Town, which indeed took place. But the crucial thing to emphasise is that Watts himself never intended the sculpture to be for Rhodes, of Rhodes,
anything to do with Rhodes.
And then shortly afterwards, in the 1920s, the sculpture, this is after Watts' death by this time, of course, the sculpture, or at least the image of it, the outline of it, was adopted by the Labour Publishing Company, which was a kind of intellectual branch of the Labour movement that published all the great kind of socialist or even communist or even anarchist tracts of the period, and all under the logo of Physical Energy. So, you know, Physical Energy is, as so many of the pictures in this room are, a very open-ended abstract allegory.
I think also it's unfair in a way to tie him to someone like Rhodes, because they were diametrically opposed in many, many ways, weren't they? And
As personalities, totally. I mean, there's Rhodes, you know, stocky, powerful, bullish chap, priding himself almost on his lack of culture, man of action, get out of my way, I've got to develop the British Empire. Whereas Watts is, oh gosh, I don't know, let me think about that, I'm rather worried about that. He's a slightly anxious intellectual type.
He's England's Michelangelo.
What I don't want to do is make it sound like, oh, Watts was on the good side
and
Rhodes was on the bad side. You know, history doesn't work like that.
No way.
As you know very well. You don't, and we shouldn't, even if we were tempted to, try to divide people who are dead up into the good guys and the bad guys. It just doesn't work like that.
But that's why it's such an interesting tale, because what it actually forces us to do as art historians is really dig as detectives and take our own modern judgments out of the situation, and say this is a vibrant London full of art, full of creativity, and full of celebrities who are rubbing up alongside
and
each
full
other.
Of power and oh, full yes. of the channels of power and full of the arteries of power, and artworks get swept up in them. I mean, a good example that many people listening to this might be able to remember is Jacques-Louis David, the famous French painter, who is the painter of the French Revolution. And then a few years later, he's the painter of Napoleon.
Absolutely.
And what does that mean, that David is inconsistent in his politics? Possibly. Of course, what it really proves is that art is almost always the tool of the very power.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Powerful. So it's a very rare artist, and conceivably you might want to argue that Picasso is one of them, who's able to resist that kind of switching between political allegiances. Watts was in many ways very naive politically. He believed in these very high-minded ideals of progress and charity and love. And,
Which is
everywhere in this room.
Yeah.
So when it came down to doing business with people like Rhodes and the kind of senior politicians who wanted physical energy to commemorate Rhodes, someone like Watts was not in a position to push them back.
No, and I think... I mean, that draws us on the idea of power and continuing power to the one that we really were going to examine, which is his famous painting, Hope. Now, I make this connection with power because, as I understand it, this image and a sermon about it inspired President Obama. Is that right?
Well, it does, for all the world, sound like one of those stories that a curator might make up to try and big up their collection. But it is actually true, and I am, very... quick to admit that there are urban myths about this painting and urban myths about Watts generally. There's a great urban myth about Hope, which shows this forlorn young woman curled up in a fetal kind of pain, trying to coax music from a lyre that is destroyed. All its strings are broken except one. She's blindfolded, isolated on a globe, pinging around the universe. She's no idea where she is. It's called Hope, and the standard joke that people have made about it for many decades is that it actually represents despair and the challenge of wrenching hope back from despair. And there's a wonderful urban legend that Nelson Mandela had a print of this painting in his cell on Robben Island, and it helped him get through those terrible years of imprisonment.
And are we supposed to see that as a myth, then?
It's not true. But it's a classic myth in the sense of it should be true. And wouldn't it be great if it were true? And everybody would really quite like it to be true. And maddeningly, it's not.
But the Obama one is.
But more interestingly, because it's true, is the fact that this is a painting that has a very strange life. After Watts' death and the kind of total collapse of the reputation of Victorian artists in the 1920s and 30s, when, you know, the Bloomsbury Group and the modernists looked back on Victorian allegory and Victorian genre painting and just, well, I was going to say they laughed at it. They didn't even bother to laugh.
No,
they just sort of walked
it's just
on,
bad,
just
isn't
ignored it.
It.
Yeah, yeah, it was just nothing to them. It was empty. It wasn't art at all. But Hope reappears on several occasions, and we're actually undertaking some research right now on this with a PhD student who's working with us in the University of Surrey. What's his image of Hope turns up in several occasions in an African-American context in the civil rights movement. So Martin Luther King preaches a whole sermon about this painting. It appears in a couple of plays put on by African-American playwrights
at the
beginning of the 20th century.
Do we know how and why it is travelling over? And
well, we know that the painting was mass reproduced in both colour prints and in black and white photography. And we know that it just seems to have been one of those pictures, as Watts always hoped it would be, and indeed how he hoped most of his pictures would be. It meant totally different things to different people in different circumstances. Okay. I mean, if this painting is about being in despair but somehow still managing to carve out hope, then which individual has not had that experience? Mm-hmm. And usually, in a very private way, considers it to be one of the most profound experiences of their life, to have recovered hope. Everyone's been through that, some in a more extreme way than others. So it was a picture, and we know this from the letters we have in our archive, from people all around, well, I won't say all around the world, but, you know, from lots of different places, writing to Watts or Mrs. Watts after GF's death, saying, I just want you to know that this picture saved my life.
Yeah.
Which sounds an extraordinary thing to say about a Victorian painting, but this is what people experience. And the reason it helped them was to realise that hope perhaps isn't all jolly, singing, dancing, slap you on the back, having a great time. Hope can actually be the thing you discover at your lowest point. And I think that that message was hugely powerful in various political contexts. And it turns out to have somehow got under the skin of the African-American civil rights movement. Jeremiah Wright, a veteran campaigner in that cause, although, of course, slightly politically compromised, it has to be said, later in his career, was a big figure in Chicago. When President Obama was a young man still contemplating a move from law to politics, he talks about, in his own autobiography, so it's from the horse's mouth, attending a sermon in Chicago based on this painting, and how he realized at the end of the sermon that his life had changed almost without realizing it, that he had seen some kind of, not literally, because the sermon, of course, is a verbal description. I mean, President Obama would not have been able at that point to have visualized the picture. He only was hearing a verbal description by Jeremiah Wright. But the image of something being rescued from nowhere obviously made him feel, gosh, it's time for me to stop making excuses and go make a difference.
So it was his awakening in many ways into politics. But I have to say, the thing that has struck me so profoundly in this particular room, which you've called Cosmos, this part...
This whole room,
Is the transcendental. And through that, I mean people like Blake...
Yeah.
See the world in a grain of sand.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
the transcendental linked to love and a sort of a divine love, because we... Mm-hmm. Last book I wrote was on Julian of Norwich, and
her phrase
is all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well.
Yeah.
And in the same way that you're saying hope as a painting has inspired people through their darkest times, there is something about the mystical, the transcendental, that gets people through the dark, because mm-hmm. out of this sort of despair comes one thread that it will be okay, mm-hmm. and it will be okay through love. And that's a really, it seems like a theme that Watts was exploring, that Blake was exploring.
Well, totally. Mm. If you look, maybe just finish with the love and life
well,
over
exactly,
here.
Exactly, that's
is,
what I was thinking
great
of.
Story around it. I mean, this is the kind of image that could have been in a 17th century mm-hmm. Christian emblem book.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would combine religious poetry with simple but effective, almost diagrams of kind of arguments about life and religion. Love is this powerful male figure with these huge wings who is helping this very skinny, I was going to say woman, but she's really a kind of child or a teenager.
Androgyny, actually. It's one of the things I've been fascinated by is how androgynous a lot of his female figures are. Like the Aurora you have in the centre.
This sculpture is both. Not one or the other, but both, right?
Totally.
Exactly.
And actually, I think you've got that here with life. Actually, there's a confusion between the genders of both, isn't there? It's sort of gender fluid in some ways.
Very, very fluid. One critic rather unkindly said it looked like two young people who've gone backpacking, but foolishly forgotten to dress for the occasion. which is kind of sweet. But it's so brutally simple.
It is.
And this is what Watts's contemporaries found shocking, that he was able to just state these allegories so directly mm-hmm. without any kind of little trick to say how self-conscious he was and how aware he was that he was doing something a bit old-fashioned, but, he, you know, don't worry, it's still modern. No, you get it totally pure, totally direct. Love is helping life up the rocky path of her existence. Life, the girl, isn't going to get there without love to help her. That's it.
Yeah.
As simple and as complex, as profound and as trivial.
And I mean, this is where I think Watts is so completely at odds with things like the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, because, yeah. I mean, you've got the hint of the daisies under his feet, yeah. but in that respect, there is none of the horrendous sort of symbol searching that you have to do with some Pre-Raphaelites. Yeah. And I think that actually two more paintings just that I really want to highlight before we stop,
sure.
that got me goosebumpy is this, a sea ghost.
Sea ghost, wonderful picture.
And then also After the Deluge. And I think that the reason they both struck me, they're both very Turner-esque in their style,
yeah.
but they have got this simple narrative underneath them, which often Turner didn't need a narrative. These are yeah. clearly giving you instruction and guidance, aren't they?
They're strange pictures. I mean, yeah. they're almost abstract decorations. I mean, we were saying, weren't we, that the Sow of the Systems is almost an abstract painting.
Mm-hmm,
well,
mm-hmm.
The After the Deluge pretty much is an abstract painting.
It is.
Okay, you can say that the big blobby stuff is the sun and the stuff below that's a bit green is the water. Okay, if you say so, and the blue stuff is the sky. But come on, that is basically an abstract painting.
It's astonishing. That and I think it's even more abstract than anything Turner does, really, because yeah. of the symmetry and the way in which there is nothing. There is nothing. There is no feature in this at all. There's not a boat, there's not a shoreline, there's not a tree. It is just the sun,
just
isn't it?
And in some ways, it's a bit like hope, the idea of reducing hope to nothingness and then building it up again. This is the reemergence of the sun, of the light after Noah's deluge, the legendary 40 days and 40 nights of God's punishment. And, of course, therefore, there isn't anything. Everything's been absolutely destroyed in the flood, and all that there is when that degree zero is reached when the turning point comes, is the light.
Yeah.
And it's about the reemergence of light. And, of course, a picture like this, which is totally symmetrical, almost entirely abstract, you can't really hang it, if you're going to hang it, anywhere other than the centre of your longest wall, because it ain't going to fit in anywhere else. I mean, it's a shape, it's a pattern, it's an abstract statement. And so we plonk that as the centrepiece of the show. We put this big sculpture of Aurora, Dawn, next to it. She's throwing off her gown to reveal herself as the resplendent new day, staring towards the creation of Eve. And then behind her, Clytie, the nymph, who the poets tell us was turned by the gods into a sunflower so she could raise her head up and down and watch the trajectory of the sun every day.
Yeah.
So
it's beautifully curated, Nick.
Well,
I'm so impressed.
Thank you.
I think what you've done is you've shown sympathy. You haven't gone chronological particularly, although you can see a slight evolution, because Watts is one of these extraordinary artists who is consistent, isn't he? And that gives you the gift of being thematic.
For people who are interested in the way that art interacts with ideas, I mean, he's fantastically appealing, because he starts in the 1840s, really, with these pretty clear ideas that life's terrible, the world is a fallen place, but even worse, I don't believe in God anymore, and so there's no one to prick it up again. Shit, what am I going to do? And the answer is, well, on one hand, I'm going to make some friendships with some extraordinary individuals,
yep.
and I'm going to look to inspirational men and women to become my friends and to sort of look up to, and then I'm going to step right back from humanity, in the case of Cosmos here, and I'm going to take not exactly happiness from, but take solace from this image of human evolution taking place within the context of the broader unfolding of the universe. And if you sort of write that down, it sounds pretty banal, really. It's probably the same as most of us feel. Life can be rubbish, but you'll get through it by
making good friends.
By friendships and a bit of philosophy. I mean, so,
and getting a sense of perspective, exactly.
And getting a sense of, nicely put. So if you just take that, which perhaps is common sense, or the common experience, and then it's refracted through these different art phases. And as we've said several times in our conversation, Watts moves through romanticism. He can remember, this is someone who can, whose lifetime and whose career overlaps with people like Turner, mm-hmm. Constable, mm-hmm. Wordsworth. Then he can remember the great realists of the 1840s, your Courbets. He can remember the Pre-Raphaelites, the Impressionists, the great illustrators of the 1860s. Then he gets to know the symbolists, and then in his very last years, whilst he's still alive, he's influencing Picasso, the young Picasso. Hope. is an influence on paintings that Picasso made in his Blue period around 1900 whilst Watts was still alive. So, you know, this is someone who moves from Turner to Picasso and those two paintings. So to watch that fundamental philosophy of life be move through art history is just really, I find, very, very exciting to think back through.
I'm not surprised. I mean, I am utterly seduced by the things I'm seeing because, as I say, I think that Watts, unlike any other of the Victorian painters, I love Leighton, I love Leighton's use of colour, I love his sculpture, but Watts seems to have taken that and tried to explore something deeper, something that is going beyond the human and yet putting human beings firmly into the narrative. And he does that unlike anyone else. I think his things are timeless. And there was a sad period. I know in 1938, Hope was taken off public of exhibition in the Tate, wasn't it? And Victorian painting was very much out of fashion.
The 30s was the nadir, really. You know, 1930s was a period when the only people writing about the Victorian artist was Evelyn Waugh.
Yeah.
And he only did it just to annoy everybody else, you know, just to, like, wind all the intellectuals up. I mean, there's a terrible moment in 1933 when there's a centenary exhibition of Burne Jones.
Oh, yeah.
To celebrate the 100 years since the birth of Burne Jones. Great big exhibition. And basically, nobody goes.
Oh.
Nobody cares. Everyone just walks through it saying, where are the Sickert paintings? you know, they're sort of, again, it's not, they don't even dislike it.
Yeah.
They can't be bothered to dislike it. It's just
abandoned, isn't it? I mean, it's almost a bit
it's like an old car.
Like when you found Aurora, because Aurora was just neglected. And in fact, the whole Watts Gallery that we're standing in was neglected, wasn't it? The building itself was
It's become very, very derelict. It was actually placed on the at-risk register.
Good grief.
And there were even conversations taking place about the possible need to transfer the entire collection to one of the national museums to preserve it because the building was no longer fit for purpose. I remember visiting it in those days when I first used to come here, and you'd come in these main galleries where we are now, and it would be so moving because you would feel that you were in the home of, say, someone who had lived to be 120 and had never changed their decoration, and you really felt, goodness me, someone's forgotten to demolish this place.
Gosh.
It's incredible. How's it survived?
Well, you talked about the fact that the artworks were in here, and yet the wires were hanging out of the walls. And
well, that's it. And that wonderful shock of romanticism lasted about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the smell of damp hit you, and then you would be taken around behind the scenes, and you would just see big chunks of masonry collapsing and tendrils of plants forcing their way through. And you think, okay,
the romantic vision is over. Let's get real.
Let's actually save this
things.
Place. And then that's amazingly, it's been done. And you know, the Watts Gallery is famous for being the home of G.F. Watts, but it's also become, we would like to think, a great sort of story of what can be done in terms of fundraising to save a special place.
Well, you are pioneers of crowdfunding. You are, you managed to secure so much in the way of heritage lottery funding to make something that is iconic and recognised around the country as a huge success story.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Well, it is. It's a huge heritage success story. And I'm very, very moved by this exhibition. I think it's absolutely extraordinary.
Great.
I have spent the whole day here.
You have.
And I have been enthusing from the second I got through the door. Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Do come along, everybody. Come along. England's Michelangelo. You've got a couple more weeks. But regardless of the timings, just come to the Watts Gallery in Compton. You will love it. You will fall in love with Watts. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to The Art Detective, which is historyhit.com/The Art Detective. And I will keep you all up to date on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you again, Nick. It's been incredible.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.